Let me start, if I may, with verses 12 to 16 of this chapter. When Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 chariots of iron, and all the men who were with him, from Hashareth-Hagoyim, to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him, and the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak at the edge of the sword. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. And Barak pursued the chariots and the army to Harosheth-Hagoyim, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not a man was left. What a terrifying story. And rather gory as well. Well, this is the era of the judges. Who were these judges? They were military and judicial leaders of a rough and ready type who followed each other over roughly a 200-year period following Israel's entry into its promised land under Joshua. And we try to understand the development of the relationship of God with his believing covenant people at a time of tremendous transition for them, transition from being a nation on the march to being a nation in charge of their own settled homeland. That's what we're seeing as we come into the book of Judges. The difficulty was that the people of Israel never really established complete control of Canaan, their new homeland. Too easily, they were content with a sort of status quo existence alongside tribal people of an entirely alien religious culture. The consequence was that Israel began to absorb those heathen practices and idolatries of their neighbors. The consequence of that, under God's hand, was the periodic oppression of Israel by these neighboring peoples. So Judges 2 and verse 14 to 16 paints the picture very clearly for us. "So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel," that's in view of the idolatries, "and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the power of their enemies round about, so that they could no longer withstand their enemies. Whenever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had warned and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in sore straits. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the power of those who plundered them." That's the theme of this book. Very painful process of education for God's ancient people. So judges such as Ehud in chapter 3 were raised up, one after another, to rally Israel, both in its theology and beliefs and also in its morale. Ehud leading his people against the Moabites, for example. Deborah in this chapter raising a standard against the Canaanites. Gideon later on against the Midianites. Jephthah against the Amorites. Samson against the Philistines. There's Israel surrounded by alien people who believe quite differently about life and existence and God and worship and belief. So here we are in chapter 4 with the emergence of Deborah. Ironically, the people of Israel were in their own promised land, but they'd lost their way militarily and ideologically, and they were now suffering from oppression once again. They'd allowed the lifestyle of the alien Canaanite people to infiltrate their own way of life, and gradually the false gods of war and sex and child sacrifice had made inroads upon their faith. They could hardly now be distinguished from the surrounding nations. So we ask, whatever had happened to the chosen people who were to bear the standard and light of the one true God to all the nations? That was their task and role. And there was a price to pay for their faithlessness. So verse 3 of chapter 4 spells that out for us. "Then the people of Israel cried to the Lord for help, for Sisera had 900 chariots of iron and oppressed the people of Israel cruelly. for 20 years. That was the price. 20 years of servitude to another power in your own promised land. It's not the pleasantest of fates, but this pattern was to be repeated and repeated in the book of Judges and way beyond, because some lessons seem to take a very long time learning. So after 5 years, you thought, oh, they must have thought this is terrible. 10 years passed by, 15 years passed by. A new generation had come who then began to say, we are fed up to the back teeth with this. Let's change things. Let's give these our enemies the heave-ho and push them out. So the cry for deliverance went up from Israel, and maybe that was the first stage on the road to recovery. You can't get anywhere in life. You can't get anything really achieved unless there is at least some desire for change, some hope, or what I might call here, first of all, a degree of aspiration. Aspiration, desire, the pattern being one of monotony, now relieved by hope. This comes easier to some temperaments than others. Wasn't it a Greek philosopher centuries ago who identified four main kinds of temperament as being first the sanguine, hopeful, bright, look on the bright side kind of person, for whom everything takes on an optimistic colour. Life is seen as alive and exciting, even if a little haywire, sometimes unfinished in the things that one tries to achieve. Bit of a gambler, but life is great. The tennis player Andre Agassi, giving every impression of being a sort of fun-loving sanguine. Or there's the melancholic, somewhat pessimistic, though highly creative, the born perfectionist, the archetype perhaps being Michelangelo, the artist. Lendl, the tennis player, maybe. Or you have the relaxed, phlegmatic, who's all for the quiet life. Non-confrontational, easygoing in relationships. Let's just be relaxed about all this. The phlegmatic. Or there's the choleric, whose life is very action-packed, highly motivated, is always certain of being absolutely right. Very dynamic, albeit with a tendency to make enemies along the road. Well, all of those tendencies have their strengths and their weaknesses. In this case, we have, I think, quite unmistakably, a choleric in Deborah, in her dealings with, well, she was dealing with a mixture of a melancholic and a phlegmatic in Barak, who is her general, who is mentioned here, of course, in this passage. And the cry goes up, let's change the situation. Now, when they said that, there was hope. For 20 years they'd knuckled under, just as their ancestors had in the land of Egypt, way back, pretending at times, perhaps, that they were in charge of their destinies, but having to rub along with these Canaanites and with King Jabin and with his general Sisera, mentioned in verses 2 and 3. Have a look at that. Keep your Bible open there. And then, of course, there was this small matter of Jabin's 900 chariots of iron that were now sort of part of the military equation, because we're in the Iron Age at this point of history. We're roughly in the 13th century BC. But with this emergence of a new judge and prophetess in the person of Deborah, there's a rustling in the spirits of God's people, aspiration for freedom once again, and the oppressive monotony begins to be relieved by a fitful gleam of hope. You can't get anywhere without such desire. It starts there. Take the very human example of the great Greek orator of old, Demosthenes. The first time he ever spoke in public, he was hissed off the platform. People thought it was a tremendous joke. They laughed and laughed at poor Demosthenes trying to get out his speech. He lisped, he stammered, he stood crookedly, his argument didn't match up at all, and he left the platform. Would he ever speak again? Ambition changed him. He decided, I will become a great orator. Just by dint of ambition, took himself away to the Aegean Sea, would stand there, allowing the feebleness of his voice to gain in strength as he competed against the roar of the Aegean breakers. He would practice running uphill and speaking as he ran uphill to improve his breathing. He would practice speaking with a pebble in his mouth to improve his diction. He would stand with a sword suspended over his shoulder to improve his crooked stance. And little by little, Demosthenes got better, to the extent that the second time he ever spoke in public, when his rival orator had finished speaking, everybody said, very good word there. Oh, very good indeed. But when Demosthenes had finished speaking, the whole audience, electrified, jumped to their feet and said, yes, we'll do what this man says. We'll go and fight the enemy. Just by dint of desire, Demosthenes had become a speaker whose speaking moved people to action. You can't get anywhere without such desire or change anything without it. Here in Judges chapter 4, 900 years before Demosthenes, here were God's people plodding along in a kind of national twilight. For years they've been the same. And then partly because there's a funny kind of security in slavery. True, you haven't got your freedom, but then at least somebody else is running your affairs, in charge of your life, setting the pace, making the decisions. There can be a security in that. When a society or an individual chooses life with God, we do so of our own free will. Nobody's going to twist your arm. If there's somebody here who's not a believer at all yet in Christ, you're simply investigating the matter. Quite frankly, nobody can buttonhole you, make you make up your mind against your own desire. Not at all. Do we want to step out of line from the boring monotony of life that goes on with its little events day after day? Do we want to step into the adventure with God? Could be uncomfortable. Step into what looks like the insecurity of life with him and become a bit of a gambler figure like Agassiz. Well, it took the people of Israel a long time before they finally aspired after their freedom. We want to change things. But the mood did indeed change with the arrival on the scene of Deborah. And now Jabin and Sisera, the 600 F-111 chariots, didn't somehow look quite so forbidding. When there's desire for change, things can begin to happen again. And monotony becomes relieved by hope. So there's aspiration for a new beginning. This is to be repeated again and again through Judges. Secondly, in our story, after aspiration, I discern a strong degree of inspiration. Inspiration, and the pattern being one of mediocrity, lifted by, let me call it, vision. The inspiration comes in the form of this woman, and what an extraordinary woman Deborah was. Israel had never had a woman leader before. The very idea didn't easily tone in with the society of that day. But this was an unusual era. It was the era of the judges. And here were these leaders raised up in Israel by God for a rude and a rough age. On the whole, they were administrative and judicial leaders with a strong military streak in them as well. And in their own way, they were spiritual people, albeit of a rough-hewn kind. They were all that God had got to work with. Rude instruments for a rude age. And so Deborah, Israel's Iron Lady, enters the stage. And as verse 5 tells us, she would sit under a certain palm tree in the hill country, and people would come to her for advice and spiritual direction for justice. So the downfall of the Canaanites under Jabin and Sisera was due to the hand of one woman, or rather two, because of Jael, who figures later in the story as we had in our reading. How could a solitary woman have done it? The answer is that ideas and beliefs are always more powerful than any war machine or political apparatus. As Alexander Solzhenitsyn observed, one word of truth outweighs the whole world. The truth is more powerful than tanks. Deborah here was a woman of spiritual inspiration. And it was her inspiration that pulled Israel out of the mud. What does she do? Why, she chooses her man, Barak, the Israelite general, and although he seems to be a bit of a plodder, somewhat mediocre, she gives him his instructions and tells him to get on with the job. It's a case of mediocrity lifted and galvanized by somebody's vision. This tends to be the pattern of the book of Judges. Deborah was terrific, but other leaders like Gideon and here Barak felt themselves to be pretty inadequate individuals. Each of them needed encouragement, injections of godly vision. But you know that yourself too. I know it very well. Then on a purely human level, Gordon Jackson was a very excellent TV actor. But there was a healthy modesty about Gordon Jackson. He didn't believe that he was good at all. Couldn't bear to watch himself on television doing the butler in Upstairs, Downstairs. So he never watched his own TV plays. But many of us are like that. We think, oh, is there anything good that I can contribute? Probably haven't got much I can do. Then when it comes to God and his kingdom, oh, let somebody else do something, but I better just stay in the back seat. Well, now Barak has to provide the necessary muscle. He's told to get on with it. And he seems strangely lacking in confidence. God's message is given to him in verses 7 and 8. When God says, verse 7, "And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon, with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." Barak said to Deborah, "If you will go with me, I will go, but if you will not go with me, I will not go." And that's the leader of the Israeli Liberation Front. Was he the best person they could come up with? I mean, nervous people have been talking like Barak all down the centuries, and of course, here it is in verse 8, he comes out to Deborah with this quavering little bleat, "I'll go if you go." That's what he's saying. Well, I don't know what General Schwarzkopf would have made of Barak. Perhaps he's just a paper general. Or is he more than that? After all, there were these legendary 900 chariots of iron. Josephus, the Jewish historian, who always exaggerated his figures, said that there were 3,000 of them. Well, maybe they looked like 3,000 as they came rumbling over the hilltop. No, it took courage to face them. It took courage for Barak to rally his 10,000 rather poorly equipped troops. It took courage to take the advice of a woman in those male-orientated days. And I think it may have taken courage to concede, verse 9, Deborah's remark that the glory from the expected battle wouldn't go to him. Do you see it there? That the glory would go to a woman. Or, as I say, two women, Deborah and Jael. Jael being the wife of Heber the Kenite, mentioned in verse 11. Deborah on the one side, Jael on the other, with the paper general sandwiched between them. One of whom he had to rely on for the idea, and the other who had to finish the job for him with a tent peg through the opposing general's head. Awful, isn't it? But then this was the era of the judges. It's Barak who has to provide the necessary resources, soldiers, equipment, strategy. So all to do, of course, with Mount Tabor, which was very near there. Assemble them there. And that brings me to a last emphasis in the saga. Desire, aspiration was required, with monotony being relieved by hope. Inspiration was required, mediocrity being lifted by vision. Then thirdly, there is what I perhaps can call perspiration. Perspiration, as we see rough and rude militancy being accommodated by God's grace. Very gory stories we find in the book of Judges. And somehow God is able to be a part of that. How can grace accommodate some of the things? He knows how to take care of these matters. So perspiration here, the hard work, it's not enough. It's not enough. If a situation needs to change, simply to wish for it to change. Across the centuries, philosophers and politicians and religious leaders alike have aspired to improve and change human nature. But, to quote Bernard Levin writing in The Times, those who plan to sit around until it happens to all mankind had better bring a cushion and a very long book. No, certainly. There comes a point when someone has to get up and do something. It's Barak's turn. But, as verse 10 tells us, Deborah went with him to Operation Mount Tabor. Other people who have done that for you, given you a bit of a push, a bit of a lift off, perhaps at the very start of your Christian experience. Let me ask, who encouraged you at the very start? Can you remember? Look back. Who encouraged you? Who got you going? With the Bible? With service? With church? Learning how to pray? Somebody got you going. Who was it, I wonder? Here, Deborah went with him. You see, when we can do that for somebody else, somebody gets us going, we must get somebody else going as well. We learn it from people like Valerie Luff, who've been with us in the fellowship and will continue in the fellowship all for many, many years. We learn it from warriors of the faith who've been ahead of us and show us how it's done. Well, the result we know is there in verse 15. Let me read it for you. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak at the edge of the sword. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. Poetically, it's described in the song of Deborah that follows in the very next chapter. Turn over the page or so to chapter 5, verse 20 and 21, I like. As the song tries to trace the story of the triumph, from heaven fought the stars, from their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent Kishon swept them away, the onrushing torrent, the torrent Kishon, march on my soul with might. Oh, could I paint the scene for you? I believe I can. I know the plain where it happened. It's the valley of Israelon. It's the plain of Megiddo. If you've ever been there to Israel, imagine that this pulpit here is where modern-day Nazareth is. Well, then Nazareth's in the north of the plain, looking down onto the plain there. Spread out, vast plain, which is one of the great battlefields of the world. Over there, to my sort of leftish, where the television camera is, are the mountains of Gilboa in the southeast. There on the BBC side, to my right, there would be the Mediterranean, of course, but then nearer at hand, the Carmel range of mountains, Mount Carmel. Mount Tabor would be behind me, just about where this behind bit of the gallery is, behind me on my left, to the northeast. And if you've ever seen that particular part of the world, this enormous plain, it's Megiddo, it's Armageddon of the New Testament. It's where the final punch-up, at least metaphorically, is going to take place. It's one of the battlefields of the world. And as you look at it, you think, history has been made here. Many times. It was made there then, on the plain of Megiddo. Elijah was to come running across the plain, across the valley of Israelon in the torrential rain on another occasion. It often rains there. When it rains, it just drenches everything in sight. The lightning flashes across the mountains of Gilboa, lightning everywhere. Then suddenly the whole thing is gone. This is what must have happened here. The river Kishon burst its banks, and there was a tremendous rain, it seems. One of the great punch-ups of the Bible, the Battle of the River Kishon, where evidently Sisera, Jabin's general, had to fight against the elements, the weather, and the mud, with those 900 magnificent chariots of iron stuck uselessly, glutinously, in the thick mud of the ravine following the intense rainstorm. It's happened more than once. It happened on April the 16th, 1799, at the Battle of Mount Tabor, in the same vicinity when Napoleon defeated the Turkish army, whose wheels similarly got stuck in the mud. General Allenby won a victory in the same place exactly earlier this century. So Psalm 83, verse 9, is just a reminder to us that they never forgot the battle of the River Kishon. Psalm 83, 9, "Do to them as thou didst to Midian, as to Sisera and Jabin at the River Kishon." And the woman's hand plays its part here in verses 12 onwards, when Sisera, forced to abandon his immobilized chariot at the end of verse 15, flees on foot and finally arrives at Jael's home. It's there she treacherously offers him refreshment, verses 18 and 19. I like the old King James version, it's where it says, "She opened a bottle of milk." I used to have visions of Jael going to the fridge and bringing out a bottle of Dairy Crest. Well, of course, I suppose it was a skin of milk. It was milk, or it may have been curdled milk, as chapter 5, verse 25 suggests, with the word curds being used. I think she served him with a yogurt, which I hate. I would have refused it. And then, as poor Sisera lies asleep in trust, the dreadful messy deed is done, with a nail, the tent peg through his head. We cannot pretend, of course, that the scriptures condone treachery of this kind. But we do recall that these were, what have I said, rude instruments for a rude age, and that human militancy is accommodated, strangely, by divine grace in these gory episodes. And that through it all, through all the muddles and the incredible human mistakes of Judges, the purposes of God's providence were being steadily worked through. This is the Judges, everybody. This is the account of Deborah and Barak. Barak needn't have worried, if he had worried, about not getting any glory. It's he, in the end, and not Deborah, who ends up in God's honor roll of the heroes and heroines of the faith in the New Testament in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 32. He gets a mention. Aspiration is required in changing a situation with monotony, relieved by hope. Inspiration is vital when mediocrity can be lifted by vision. And perspiration has to follow with, in this case, militancy and even violence being accommodated by grace from above. When there are changes afoot, changes needed in our lives, I suggest that these three aspects all have some part to play. They must do. And next week, we come on to the theme of a rough justice, still in Judges. Let's pray. We think, O Lord, not only of our so untidy and tormented world, we also think of our extremely muddled lives. We long that out of the chaos that we see internationally and that we also see personally, there may come order and purpose and grace and triumph. As we allow the inspiration of your own presence to do its work in our lives and the strength of your word to change defeated situations into purposeful ones. We ask this for your name's sake. Amen.